So we've got quite a bit of time for questions, and in fact, I thought what I'd do is perhaps if the three of you, if there's any questions that each of you wanted to ask each other, perhaps do that first and then open it up to the audience. Was there anything that...
I was just sitting there enjoying it. I didn't know I'd be put on the spot like this.
Yeah. Well, it's only if a question's come into your mind. If it hasn't, then it hasn't.
Yeah.
But anything?
No, I just was really interested in how Florence's work overlapped with the work that we do as well, and trying to advocate. And there's so many of us trying to do things and trying to... There's so many of us trying to kind of promote things and do things, but I always get concerned because we're preaching to the converted, yeah. And it's kind of, you know, the wider audience needs the education that's so lacking for so many people.
But what's happening to the new...
So it's supposed to be statutory by September 2019. The guidance was updated for the first time in 20 years. It had, we heard, over 600 responses from anti people who didn't want it to be put into legislation. Yeah, sorry, can you hear me now?
Maybe just talk into it now.
Yeah. Sorry, we heard that there are over 600 responses to people, parents, teachers, whoever, not teachers, parents, etc., anti groups who didn't want it to go into legislation. Most people think that sex ed is in legislation already, and it's not. You can withdraw your child from it. It doesn't have to be taught in any other way than biological. There just seems to be this misguided approach to it. We're so behind the other Western European countries. I mean, we have the highest teenage pregnancy rate, even though it's gone down by 50%.
Yeah, I got withdrawn from RE when I was at school. Yeah, I think I should read the Bible now. In fact, that'll be my retirement. I might engage in that project. With your leaflet, though, the new one, what's... I mean, can you bring that out? Oh, it's out already.
You mean the talk?
The one that you... Yeah.
So that's an online resource for teachers, and it has lesson plans, so right. Specifically for teachers to teach. The other leaflet as well was, you know, it's very popular. People, parents and teachers who want to educate their children.
So they are available now.
Yeah, they're available. Everything's available on our site, and we provide most materials to secondary schools and primary schools. Right.
I mean, I guess one point that I didn't bring up, but I'm curious for you as well, and maybe it's also a cross-nation experience. It's been very hard to work in this field. It's you're constantly...
You've got
a lot of hair here. It's very hard, and you're pushing against lots of boundaries of people pushing against you, but also the way that when you work in sex or sexuality or things that are difficult conversations for people, the judgment that then comes towards you as a person.
Yeah.
Particularly, I think, since as a female working in this subject matter, I know that, you know, from 22 to 35 working in the Museum of Sex in New York City, where the first question out of people's mouths is, what do you do? That people would assume lots of things. I assumed that I was a sex worker, to assume that I was a dominatrix, to assume that that meant they could tell me everything about their pornographic viewing or interests, or I was propositioned going into the museum, going into my office by a man who thought the Museum of Sex was a code word for location to purchase sex. because there's so much misinformation, I found that it's been a difficult road to engage with how the world encounters you when you work in a field so openly about sex. So maybe I'd love to hear your experiences.
Yeah, I get some really weird personal attacks towards me when an article was published in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency that then got reposted by people like the Jerusalem Post and Haaretz and everything. I thought, oh great, my community will finally get on board with this, because I was totally expecting like the Jewish community to just totally ignore me. But the opposite happened. I ended up being... I was opened up to a whole world of anti-Semitic abuse that I didn't realise existed. And I got listed on all these very strange websites called Judas Watch. And the Vagina Museum had been up for a while, but it was just suddenly like, oh, a Jewish woman is doing it. Oh, my God, we've got to take this down. You know, it's very strange. People saying, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. A lot of this comes from TERFs as well, trans exclusionary feminists, who say, I don't like, someone genuinely said in a poster, they said, why have you used the word people instead of women? And I so wanted to reply, do you not consider women people? Is that not an accurate word at the very least? Mm. But I get a lot of people who don't like the idea that we are not defining people with vaginas as women and recognizing that there's actually a lot more nuance in it. Mm.
For us, it's really hard. I mean, we've been, back again. Our organisation's been going for 90 years, so, mm-hmm. and it's been encountering this for around 90 years. Mm-hmm. And it is really difficult because we try to influence policy and we do lobbying work. And, you know, without meaning to get into politics, Labour will be our friend and we'll want to talk about this. But it's really hard to try and get to talk to Conservative ministers. I'm not saying they're all like that. I mean, it was a Conservative government who passed this legislation. But, you know, it is really tough to try and influence policy. Mm-hmm. And when I often make jokes about it, so I will tell people I'm a sex worker because I just, you know, I kind of...
I mean, you work in sex.
I've said it too.
Yeah, and it's because I get really irritated. And I'm really privileged to work in a field that I absolutely love. And in my organisation, we have amazing conversations and we're all very open. And we all have boundaries. We don't overshare about our own. It's not about us, but it's about mm-hmm. a very important issue. And I think it's great that we are getting more communicative and verbal about it. I'd never heard of TERFs, though. That's kind of a whole new terminology to me.
Really?
I can't believe that. And that's really quite upsetting as
well. There's TERFs and then there's SWERFs as well. SWERFs is sex worker exclusionary radically feminists who say feminism should not, there shouldn't be a place for sex work in feminism.
Gosh. Yeah.
There should or shouldn't?
Shouldn't.
There shouldn't. They're exclusionary, so they don't like sex work. I don't know. I talk about myself all the time. I tell everybody I can about how I have asymmetrical labia. Because, look, if we're not talking about our own, how can we talk about other people? Thank you for that one clap. My labia has never been clapped before.
It has now.
Not in public, anyway.
Not in private, either. I'm going to tell my boyfriend this is the next thing we're doing.
Just thinking about the... I can think of one conference that was tried to be put on. It was about 1991, I think, and it was... I could be wrong about this, but I think it was Valerie Sinison, who's a well-known psychoanalyst, and she tried to put on a conference about masturbation, and I think she got one person to sign up for it, and it had to be cancelled. So we may be a first, who knows?
My question is about museums, not about sex. And because legislation can be different in the US from the UK, because both of you have said that you've encountered a great amount of resistance, does it require a license? You said that yours, for example, an entrepreneur is behind it. Mm-hmm. Does it require a license, an application process to get a museum? Because fundamentally, it's meant to be an educational institution. Mm-hmm. So regardless of all the jokes around it, on a serious note, if this is about changing ideally cultures, perceptions in the long run, approaches and attitudes, it requires education in one form or another, if it's tricking about people mm-hmm. into education. But does it require an application process? Does it need to go through authorities? Because that's how you could make your case, and indeed then people know what to expect when they mm-hmm. go through your doorstep with regards to, you know, what this is about. So yeah. Is that something that...
I mean, well, museums can be accredited, and museums can exist without accreditation in the United States. All right. So the Museum of Sex was a non-accredited, so there's the American Association of Museums, I believe. And so you have to go through certain protocols, but it's everything down to how are you going to store your permanent collection? How are you going to manage... I mean, there's many, many, many layers of that accreditation process. You know, we were talking about this earlier. It was very hard working for the museum, not because I had very, you know, all those beginning years, it was like a startup. There's very little funds coming in and making exhibitions out of nothing. Like, I can repurpose anything and change it into something at this point. It's a great, great personal skill set, but it's hard. And then, but the flexibility that we had would be impossible anywhere else. So, you know, in a typical museum, and yours, I think, works a little bit more in that traditional, you have a board, you have, you know, you come up with ideas, the board has to get approval, there's, you know, a group of people. We can make decisions like that. A little hard if you've done, you know, X amount of work to form an exhibition and then paths change, but we have to remain agile to keep our doors open. You know, you have to be creating content that it hits all of the notes. And then we also can't pretend that all of the major museums are not businesses. I mean, they work as businesses. They have, you know, money coming in that supports them, you know. So I think the museum, the ticket price of the Museum of Sex has changed and gone up over time, but it's nowhere, it's still, I think, less than, you know, MoMA or, you know, this one or that one that get millions and millions and millions of funds coming in. So I think that's always just, you know, it's a good balance of, you know, not forgetting what museums, they have wonderful missions, but they also, they have the money-making side to them as well.
From the perspective of the UK really quickly, so there are four kind of major things in this area which we're battling against, because the thing is, like you said, anyone could call them a museum. Museum isn't a protected word. So there's accreditation, which in the UK, you have to be, your museum has to be open to the public for 2 years before you can apply for accreditation. And then there's the Charities Commission. So most museums in the UK are charities. And when you make your app, we're doing this right now. When you're making your application to the Charity Commission, you have to say, like, what's the public benefit? And you've got to prove to the Charity Commission and they decide whether, you know, they think that you're worthy of charitable status. Fingers crossed we will be. We'll see in like 12 weeks or whatever. Then there's the Obscenities Act, which I don't know yet how we're going to go around it, because the Obscenities Act is very moralistic in its wording. So it's one that's very open to interpretation. And then there's pornography rules. So there are going to be certain sections of the Vagina Museum where we physically, like, with the age ID legislation that's just been brought in, people will not be able to come into certain parts of the museum because it's got pornography in without showing a driving license or something. So,
and back to, it's very hard when you're making content for adults to not show things and what they exist in reality. So to censor the content, you're not doing the educational mission properly. You know, you can't. You know, if I'm going to do an exhibition about, I did an exhibition about Linda Lovelace and Deep Throat, and I had a whole wall projection, probably twice the size of this, of her doing the act of deep throating, because that's what the film is about. That's what the whole, you know, I can't not show the thing that is the most salient point of the movie and her career, but it would be too graphic, you know.
Hi, my question is mainly for Natika, but I'm interested as to what you guys might think as well. I'm a music therapist and I work with, part of my work is with young adults who have severe special needs, and there have been instances of masturbation in some of my sessions. And I've been thinking about this all day really, because A, we haven't had much discussion about the needs of people with special needs and disabilities and their sexual needs, but also because we've been talking about masturbation, the discourse today a lot about it, you know, it being related to shame and it being related to sin. And actually, in my experience, for the people I'm working with, it's much more affirmative. It's a very important way of having some autonomy over their bodies. When you were saying about young people really being watched all the time, you know, for their own safety or whatever, there's all sorts of politics around it potentially. Yeah. And that's something that I've had a lot of experience of as well. So my question really is, can you just say a little bit more about the work you've been doing with people with learning disabilities, but also what you found out their experiences of masturbation are and what the purposes are behind it in those cases?
Sure. So I'll try and find my speaker. Okay, my mic, sorry. I can't tell you directly about your experiences because I don't work directly with people with learning disabilities. So we have projects across the country. And the idea about them being watched all the time is that they don't get given the right privacy.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to advocate is we're trying to, you know, teach their carers that actually if you, they need their own private space. And if they understand the difference between private and public space and they are given the right education, then they can enjoy their own bodies and in a way that they need to or want to. So we would, I think we're very much along the same lines as you are. I mean, what we end up doing is going into schools or educational institutions, etc., and writing guidance for teachers and people so that they can actually learn how to treat people with learning disabilities in a respectful way so that they can appreciate their own bodies. Because for some people who are severely have severe learning disabilities, they may never have a relationship with another person. Their own self may be the only person they ever have that relationship with. Mm. And masturbation is a key element of that. But it's difficult because they, you know, I think we get called in at the point where the problems start. They're masturbating all the time, or they're getting an erection, or something's happening. And it all, I think the key, it always comes down to education and being open. And actually, we're all sexual beings regardless, and having that attitude, really.
Yeah, and I'd say onto that, visibility is a really important component of all of that. It's many, many years ago at this point, but I did do an exhibition about sex and disability. It was featuring the photography of an Australian photographer, Belinda Mason Loving. And so she photographed lots of people within the disability community in Australia, and they helped to self-create the image. So it was, that was the important kind of collaborative communication, and then we displayed her photography in the museum, and then had it had text from the individuals about this process and what it meant to them, and then the act of co-creating the images. So I think that there's more and more efforts to, I mean, there's, in the US there are a couple of different groups that are really trying to push this this understanding of sex and disability to a much, you know, more visible space. And that, you know, that sexuality, you know, it shouldn't be this invisible entity that nobody's talking about.
I'm just thinking, we did a campaign about 10 years ago for people with learning disabilities. We have learning disabilities, and there were photographs. And the campaign was called It's My Right. And we got a lot of complaints about it, because why were we showing people with disabilities in sexual, you know, and they were naked. And if you go onto our website, which is fpa.org.uk, and go into the campaign section, you'll see these images. And they're beautiful, of people just enjoying and being. People don't want to see it. So I think when you talk about attitude, I mean, it's kind of, I just don't think we're particularly progressive at all. And I think while it is trying to be a bit more visible, I think it's kind of, you know, it's better over there.
And then some of these images were very graphic. I mean, there was this is so many years ago, I'm kind of trying to access my memory bank, but there was this one couple, and I feel like the wife had MS, and so the only way that they could engage in sexual encounters was through this homemade sex machine that they had created, and that allowed them to have the physical. So I think they had a photograph with her, and I think she was partially nude with the sex machine. I can't remember exactly, but that, you know, really, you know, not just alluding to the sexuality, actually, you know, being able to embrace it in a very graphic, and I don't mean that in a negative way, graphic way.
Just as a side point, in the summer, the Vagina Museum is bringing its pop-up exhibition to a conference in Paris, which is called My Sexuality is Not a Disability. And it's just a conference for people in the disabled community, healthcare practitioners, etc., to go and learn about what sexuality is like for disabled people.
Hi, it's more for both the museums. I was thinking about the art world and how that has changed over the years, particularly when we think about the work of female artists. When you were talking about New York, I immediately thought of Judy Chicago, and wondered, you know, how you work in conjunction, in a sense, or take note of that, because it's a creative way of, you know, bringing things to people's, you know, attention. Can be very controversial, we know, but, you know, it's also there in art galleries, etc. And so how you might include it, I was thinking about, you know, the Vagina Museum in particular, because of course living in London, you know, what your thoughts are about those links to what's happening in that very creative way too.
I mean, the world, they 100% intersect. And I think, okay, so you go into a museum, you have to see things, you know, and it's very hard when you take topics like sex. What do you see? What are the physical objects that represent something that is an act or something that is a thought or something that is, you know, How do I represent, you know, sex acts that happened 3,000 years ago? You know, and it's through objects. And art has been a wonderful means through which to tell those stories. I've also had incredible, the things that have most defined my career is meeting with collectors of these objects, and going to basements and attics and digging around and, you know, having people to really earn people's trust to share the stories of why they collected X, Y, and Z, you know, it's intimate. This is part of, it's connected to their, mostly their sexual, you know, practice. We had one collector, it's not fine art, but he was a former librarian at the Library of Congress and collected pornography for 30 years and cataloged it in the same methodology as the Library of Congress. And he had 900 boxes. That we took on as a museum. And he lived with it. Floor to ceiling boxes of like Ass Man 12 and Linda. I mean, these are, you know, the real boxes that he was living with his, you know, 90 something year old Southern mom surrounded by all of these.
Did she know what was in there?
I mean, you couldn't not. So you have the collectors, the kind of this like ephemeral kind of object. And then this fine art world. And so to go back to that fine art world, the fine art world likes to talk about sex sometimes, but sometimes it's still very uncomfortable. You go to most artists at some point in their lives have made some kind of erotic, sexually oriented content. You go to art fairs, and mostly that is not what the gallery is putting out there. You know, so my job would go to like the Art Basels and go to these different places, and I'd be that kind of creeper, be like, so I love what you're doing over here, but where's your sex stuff? Like, where's your this? And trying to dig around. I've had artists who, one artist, I won't use her name, but she did work with real dolls. Real dolls are $10,000 silicone, fully articulated dolls that people have sex with. Some people live with them as partners. So she photographed these dolls. And we had real dolls at the museum on display. Her gallery would not let her exhibit her photographs of the dolls in the museum because of our unabashed, you know, relationship with the subject matter. So it's a very hard, you know, there's the art world and the museum world and the identity world. They're all connected, the creative world, but there are politics, there is money, there is, you know, all of these things that still kind of get interwoven into the decision making of people.
For vaginas in art specifically, I have a very long document about all the things that I want to borrow, because so many of the things are in storage because museums and art galleries don't know how to display them. So like Black Iris by Georgia O'Keeffe is not on display. So many things are not on display, and I'm going to poach them from all over the world.
I love it.
Thank you. But the vaginas and vulvas have been in art much longer than penises ever have. For tens of thousands of years ago, it was vaginas, vulvas, vulvas, vulvas. And then for like, honestly, thousands of years. And then suddenly people were like, oh, maybe we should draw penises as well. But you don't ever see the vaginas and vulvas in museums. You see the penises a lot. You see all these penis amulets and, you know, like the Naples History Museum and stuff, but you never see the vaginas because people don't know how to broach them. The curators, maybe you would.
I just have to go everywhere. Yeah. That is my secret dream, to go into every museum's collection and just kind of be honest and be like, look at all this great stuff that I can make amazing exhibitions with that you've hidden away. Yeah. It's so sadly and not, you know... There's a famous Picasso painting of he did when he's prepubescent, and it's him receiving oral sex. And I think, who is it? The Met, I think, that owns it. And they never display it. And it's amazing. It's so amazing that Picasso made this piece. And they're like, oh, it's one of the lesser works. It doesn't need to be shown. That's exactly the work that needs to be shown.
I have more of a encouragement comment. But you were talking about how difficult it is to pierce through in the academia with anything that has anything to do with sex or sexuality. As you know, the Nordic countries, well, you were talking about how England was, well, had a stiff upper lip like in the US. I've lived in the United States for a long time as well, so I'm familiar with that. And so now I live in France, and I thought that, well, the French, oh my goodness, they have got to be so open about it. No way. Yeah. We were talking earlier about my 10-year-old daughter who's asking all these questions, and my neighbors and my friends, their friends' parents are saying, oh my God, I hope you don't tell them anything. It's too early. I'm like, she's 10. She's going to have boobs next year.
Yeah.
So, okay. But that wasn't the point. I was, as I became a writer, I wanted to write frank sexual depiction. And this is something that I'm renowned for today. But in the beginning, mm-hmm. what happened is, well, first of all, to find a publisher, I did eventually, but the first novel that was frank and talked about sex in its real, with its real names and real, in a realistic manner, without being erotic at the same time, because erotica always finds its public, but no, this is just novels with frank sex. I could not, there were a few stores who actually wrote to the publisher saying, this is pornography and this is something that should be hidden away. And this is in Finland we're talking about, so mm-hmm. Nordic countries. So the first series of novels came through and I got a lot of feedback about it being pornography. But now it's okay, so I write the second one about Marquis de Sade and such and such. But now, all of a sudden, I'm talking about masturbation in the next novel. And even my publisher starts to kind of shrink away, saying, oh, do you really want to do that? Is that something that you, are you sure you want to? That's kind of a tough subject. And yes, I'm like, yes, I'd really like to do that. Oh, how about writing a nice medieval novel first? And something you can go with your frankness, but the masturbation is not. I'm going to write about masturbation. So now it's coming up, and I'll keep you posted on how many, what kind of commentaries we're going to have, and I'm going to link you on Twitter with the Vagina Museum and the Sex Museum in New York. So good luck with your efforts.
Well, you say about medieval books, but I don't know if anyone has read Game of Thrones, like the series, A Song of Ice and Fire. It's really interesting because it includes frank depictions of sex. Like, because when he was writing it, he was like, why do these fantasy novels, you know, they talk about all these things, and then always it's like, when you expect sex to happen, it just doesn't, you know. And it was like, well, I'm just going to write it because sex is a part of life. And people were a bit like, aren't these books for teenagers though? And he was like, well, yeah. And he started writing these in the 90s, you know. Then again, he's like an old white man, so he can kind of get away with it, I guess.
Well, it's interesting that, so are you from Finland?
Yes.
So my book, Sex in the Museum, the first language that it was translated into was Finnish. And I was like, oh, this is very exciting. But even that process I've worn the hat of curator. So I'm curator of sex. And as a writer of writing this story of working in the museum. And it was with a very large publishing house in the US, which is great. You're so excited. I've got this book deal. But it's also, they have to think about the market. And it's not surprising that the cover of my book, it's a bright pink. And it's a New York, it's always pink. Sex books are always pink or lime green, or there's like maybe one other color, sex toys are always purple. Yeah, there's this trend. And then it was a New York City skyline, and the Empire State Building is a vibrator.
Ah.
And because, of course, they play into the markability of Sex in the City. And they wanted a little bit of my narrative to somehow be like Sex in the City, which it's not really who and what I am or want to be or want to aspire to. I'm a mixed race person who was born in Arizona, who grew up in Manhattan. So it wasn't like me coming to the big city because it was already my hometown. And my goal in life wasn't to, you know, get married. It had happened, but it wasn't. And to go back and forth with trying to create what that narrative looks like, because what's a sellable narrative of a young woman finding herself working in this crazy, you know, entity? It has to be a little bit about, oh, and I just wanted to get married, and I just wanted to do this, and I just wanted to do that. You know, that's the way that we construct, you know,
Hi. Firstly, thank you for really fantastic talks. They were so interesting. Just a couple of comments to Sarah. I think my supervisor might have helped with the sex and animals, Volker Sommer.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, in the primate section.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, that's my PhD supervisor. Okay. And also for my PhD, I found it incredibly difficult to get funds. So I just lied until it came to actually giving them my proposal. So, a few shocked faces in that room. I just wanted to ask you, Florence, before I did my PhD, I did some work on the evolution of the penis bone. And you were mentioning that it's a shame we don't look more at female genitalia. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to do that, the sort of homologue of the penis bone is the Borbellum, which is quite a nice name for the clitoral bone, but the information just is not out there. So I did this huge comparative study with thousands of different species, and I think there might be a handful of examples of the clitoral bone. So I just wanted to ask maybe your thoughts on how people that would like to look more at female genitalia could do that when sort of historically it's just been put away and shunned, and the information isn't there in order to generate theories to test in a way, which would be fantastic to do, but how might you suggest that people could go forward doing such a thing?
Well, we got to do our own research, you know? I'm going to set up the Vagina Museum, but once we're a few years in, one of the things I really want to do is host researchers, because, for example, so Helen O'Connell is the surgeon who discovered the internal anatomy of the clitoris. And the reason she did that is because she was studying for her surgical exams in Australia. And she realized there was very little literature on the clitoris. And she wanted to learn about it because she was becoming a urogenital surgeon. And she was like, wow, there really isn't anything. So she started kind of doing her own primary research. And she discovered these internal anatomies. And she was like, oh, my God, totally blew the world away. We just got to do it ourselves, basically, because even if you do go into history, you'll find out some of the strangest things. Vesalius, who is like one of the ultimate medical anatomists of the 1600s, he said in response to Columbo discovering the clitoris, so that's two members of the Columbus family who have discovered things that were already discovered, but he said, can't help it, but so he said, oh, Columbo, you absolute idiot, I have never seen a clitoris in a normal human female. I have only ever seen a clitoris in hermaphrodites, is the word he used. And it was like, really? Vesalius? The person who bucked the tradition of Galen of not studying humans, studying animals. He was like, no, actually, I'm going to cut up humans and have a look inside and what their organs look like. He even thought clitorises weren't real. So, like, we just got to do it ourselves.
I think that's a pretty good place to stop. We've got to do it ourselves. So, and if you want to go and get your cups of tea, that's right.